Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today, we've got some election returns for you from across the nation, San Diego, and East County, starting with Mrs. Clinton's big win here in California, and then on to the local congressional races, including one that shows an incumbent congressman just may be vulnerable in November. And out here in East County, there's a shocking result in a race in which a candidate who dropped out will be moving on to November, and we'll tell you why on today's show. San Diego voters have approved raising the minimum wage. Stay tuned for details on that. Jonathan Goetz will be joining us today to discuss the outcomes in the San Diego mayoral, city council, and city attorney races, where yet another glass ceiling may soon be broken. We'll tell you about the outcome of the Grossmont Community College District Board race, the U.S. Senate race, and then on the second half of our show today, we'll bring you some of our Best of East County reruns, including our interview with the owner of the Hearts and Hands Zebra Ranch out in Ramona. Yes, you heard that right. As well as our interview with the late, great Gary McClintock, the famous saddle maker from Descanso. Plus, we'll tell you about an award recently won by the Grossmont Healthcare District. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. For the first time in U.S. history, a woman is poised to be the nominee of a major political party in the presidential race in November. Hillary Clinton has taken nearly 56% of the vote in California over Senator Bernie Sanders at 43%, capturing enough pledged delegates to secure the number needed for the Democratic Party nomination. Clinton, who also leads soundly in superdelegates, is now the presumptive Democratic Party nominee, though Sanders has said he will remain in the race until the party's convention in July. Clinton changed her Twitter photo to read, "History Made." Declaring victory, she stated on Tuesday, "Tonight's victory is not about one person. It belongs to generations of women and men who struggled and sacrificed and made this moment possible." She also took aim at Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee. Clinton said, "Trump is trying to wall off Americans from each other. When he says, 'Let's make America great again,' that is code for 'Let's take America backwards,'" Clinton added. She also criticized Trump for recent attacks on a judge of Mexican descent here in San Diego, as well as his mocking a disabled reporter and calling women pigs. Clinton, the former Secretary of State, Senator, and First Lady, added that her mother taught her never to back down from a bully. At a Democratic Party celebration at the Westin San Diego Gas Lamp Tuesday night, Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, who represents San Diego and part of East County, voiced joy at the outcome. She said, "It is an amazing experience to believe we will have the first opportunity to elect a woman to see what people used to say was the impossible happen." Weber also criticized Donald Trump's "Make America Great Again" slogan. The Assemblywoman, an African-American daughter of a sharecropper, observed, "He talks about the good old days, but they were not good for me." She slammed Trump for refusing to release his tax returns and for having no record of accomplishments, as well as Trump's negative statements about women, Mexican immigrants, Muslims, and others. Weber said, "We have the most inclusive vision to move this nation forward," referring to the Democratic Party, adding, "I love a good fight, and this is one." Trump won with 75% of the vote in California as the only Republican candidate still in the race. And he has more than enough delegates nationwide to be the presumptive nominee for the Republican Party. One Trump supporter in San Diego complained that Hillary will ruin this country. After the primary, Trump read from a teleprompter instead of delivering his usual unscripted remarks. Trump told voters, "Together we accomplished what people thought was absolutely impossible." He noted that his campaign received more Republican votes than any campaign in history. He then took aim at Clinton. "To those who work for someone else in either party, I'll work hard to earn your support," he said, and then issued a specific appeal to Sanders supporters, noting that he opposes what he called terrible trade deals like Sanders. He stated, "My goal is to bring people together, but if I'm forced to fight for something, I will never, ever back down." Miriam Plotkin, a Democratic Central Committee member from La Mesa and Clinton supporter, said that she hopes Mrs. Clinton will choose Bernie Sanders as her vice presidential running mate. She said, "I do believe Bernie Sanders will be asked first, and if for any reason he does not accept, then Senator Elizabeth Warren will be asked second. The only way to unite people when they separate is to come together," the longtime Democratic activist from East County said. Clinton also won New Jersey and New Mexico in Tuesday's primaries, while Sanders won North Dakota and Montana. The two candidates tied in South Dakota. But California, which has by far the most delegates of any state in the nation, awarded 257 to Clinton and 188 to Sanders, virtually securing Clinton's victory with 2,184 pledged delegates to Sanders' 1,804. When the superdelegates, who vote in July, are added in, Clinton's lead widens to 2,755 to Sanders at 1,852. Despite the seemingly insurmountable odds, Sanders told supporters he will stay in the race through the last primary next week in Washington, D.C., and then take his fight for social, economic, and environmental justice all the way to the convention in Philadelphia. But he added that his fight does not end with the primary. "Let me thank you all for being part of a political revolution," Sanders told his supporters on Tuesday night. "We understand our mission is more than just beating Donald Trump. It is transforming our country." The Vermont senator concluded, "This struggle is not over." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Incumbents beat challenges soundly in East County's three congressional districts and one San Diego district, but San Diego Congressman Daryl Issa could face an upset in November. With 100% of San Diego County's precincts tallied, here are the results in five local districts. Issa, a Republican, has 49% of the vote. Democrat Doug Applegate has 48%, trailing Issa by just 1% in San Diego County, while Ryan Wingo has 3%. The district also includes part of Orange County, where Issa fared better, leading 57% to 39%, but with far fewer voters. Adding both counties together, Issa has 51%, Applegate 45%, and Wingo 3%. Wingo is a nonpartisan candidate running on a platform of legalizing marijuana and opposing war. Wingo voters would be most likely to vote Democratic in a two-person runoff, meaning Issa could be in for a tough battle in November to hold onto his seat. In the 50th Congressional District, encompassing most of East County, Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter took 58% of the vote and will square off for a runoff against Democrat Patrick Malloy, who took 22%. David Secor, a Democrat running for the second time, had 11%. Republican Scott Meisterlin had 10%, and Fuji Shiora, a nonpartisan candidate, 3%. In the 51st Congressional District, encompassing the southern portion of East County and Imperial County, Democratic Congressman Juan Vargas waltzed to an easy win with 67% of the votes in San Diego County and nearly three-quarters of the votes in Imperial County. All federal races require a runoff among the top two candidates, so Vargas will square off in November against Republican Juan Hidalgo Jr., who got 16% of the vote locally. Democratic Congressman Scott Peters in San Diego won 59% of the vote in the 52nd Congressional District and will face Republican Denise Gitchum, who got 16%. The five challengers, all Republicans, took a combined 41% of the vote, so Peters seems likely to win his runoff this fall. In the 53rd Congressional District, Congresswoman Susan Davis had an easy win with 65%, or nearly two-thirds of the votes. She will run off against Republican Jim Ash, who had 16%. Republican James Veltmeyer had 15%, and Democrat Nick Walpert, 4%. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Meridian Broaddus.
This is Miriam Raftery with a shocking development in the race to fill the 71st Assembly seat vacated by Brian Jones due to term limits. It turns out that the runoff in November will be between Santee Mayor Randy Vopel and jeweler Leo Hamill, even though Hamill announced he was dropping out of the three-way race shortly after the June primary ballots were printed. That's because despite dropping out, Hamill finished second, ahead of businessman Tony Tiora, who placed third. Sam Mahood, the press secretary for California's Secretary of State Alex Padilla, told us that in state legislative races, the top two names on the ballot advance to the general election no matter what. Well, almost, no matter what. Asked about the unusual circumstances in the 71st Assembly District, Mahood said, the only way a candidate could be removed from the ballot is by dying or via court order. A court order would have to be obtained 68 days before the election, according to state elections law. San Diego Registrar of Voters Michael Vu confirmed it's true, assuming the preliminary election results don't change. Once all those mail-in and provisional ballots are counted and the election certified, Hamill will be on the ballot. The district includes parts of San Diego and Riverside counties. Currently, Vopel and Hamill are up by substantial leads over Teori in both areas. All three candidates are Republicans, but there are substantial differences in their views on issues ranging from climate change to abortion. Teori told East County Magazine that he is surprised and disappointed in this outcome. He questions why talk show host Carl DeMaio endorsed Hamill even after Hamill announced on DeMaio's show that he was dropping out of the race. Teori concludes, to me, it shows the whole sham of the system.
By a resounding 63% to 37% margin, San Diego voters have approved raising the minimum wage for all workers at all places of employment in the city. The ballot initiative also mandates 40 hours of paid sick leave a year for full-time workers. Proposition I will raise the minimum wage by 50 cents immediately and to $10.50 an hour as soon as the election results are certified. Wages will rise to $11.50 on January 1st, then increase with the Federal Consumer Price Index on January 1st, 2019, and annually thereafter based on inflation. Mickey Kasperian, head of the San Diego Imperial County's Labor Council, told East County Magazine, "We're thrilled about the Prop I," adding, "San Diego will be ahead of the state by 2.5 years. Governor Jerry Brown signed state law earlier this year to increase the minimum wage from $10 to $12 in January 2017, then rising by a dollar a year up to a capacity of $15 an hour by 2022. The governor could suspend those increases during economic downturns. However, a provision that is not in the city's measure. State law also does not provide the mandatory increases tied to inflation that the city measures provides. San Diego City Council previously approved a minimum wage hike, but business groups opposed to it got signatures to initially block implementation and force a public vote. Voters have now made clear that they support higher wages and paid sick leave for San Diego's lowest paid workers. Reverend Shane Harris, with the National Action Network in San Diego, which canvassed districts to get voters to the polls in support of the ballot initiative, called to the action historic. He added, "This is a big step, but we need to keep going until we get to $15 an hour." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Chisato Everson.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is Miriam Raftery, and now I'm here with Jonathan Goetz, our correspondent, who has been tracking the San Diego city races for us. Jonathan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Miriam.
So today we're going to be talking about the outcomes in the San Diego mayoral race, the city council races, and the city attorney race. Let's start with the mayor. I guess there's some big news there.
The mayor will not be facing a runoff in November, so it was decided in June. The turnout statewide was expected to be as high as 60%, with only 30% turnout in the city of San Diego. That could be part of the reason why.
Wow. So Mayor Kevin Faulkner won re-election outright, no runoff. What percentage of the vote did he get?
58%.
The other two candidates in the race were Lori Saldana, running as an independent, and Ed Harris, who was the endorsed Democratic candidate. How did they fare?
Lori Saldana came in second place with 22% of the vote, just above Ed Harris, who received almost 20.
Wow. So even though she was not endorsed by any party, she actually came in second. Very interesting.
Well, she had a lot of following during her time in the assembly, and she's run, so she had pretty good name ID.
It's true. I mean, she formerly was a Democrat before she became a declined estate, and she also ran for Congress, actually, and, you know, did fairly well there, although she didn't win. So with the Republican mayor, Kevin Faulkner, reelected, it's important for Democrats to try to hold on to the city council, obviously. How is that looking? The Democrats have a one-vote majority currently on the city council. Now, how many seats were up for re-election this time?
It was the 5 odd-numbered seats that were up for re-election. The solidly Republican seats, council members were re-elected in districts 5 and 7.
So that was Councilman Kersey and?
Kersey and Sherman.
So Councilman Kersey and Sherman, two Republicans, won re-election. So I understand there was also one Democrat that?
Yes, Senate Chief of Staff Chris Ward won his election in the race to succeed Todd Gloria, and he won it with almost 60% of the vote. So there won't be a runoff in District 3.
So that was an open seat, but the Democrats hold on to the seat in the election.
Yes. The main toss-up seat is District 1, which is the coastal seat currently represented by Council President Sherry Leitner. Mm-hmm. And that's the one that will determine whether or not Democrats maintain their one-seat majority.
So Sherry Leitner is a Democrat. Is she running for re-election?
She is not. She is termed out. However, her husband did run as one of the people who ran to try to keep Ray Ellis, who's a Republican, from getting over 50%. In the primary.
So how did that strategy work out? I understand the Democrats had a whole pack of people running to try to keep the Republican from getting the majority.
Well, this was a little bit of a surprise here. Democrats, as you said, were running several people just to try to keep Ray Ellis from getting 50%. He ended up only getting 33%, and it was actually Barbara Bree who was kept from winning outright.
Very interesting. Now, she got 49%? She came very, very close to winning the 50% majority that would have been an outright victory and meant there would be no runoff. So do you think the Democrats maybe made a mistake with that strategy?
Well, I think it's easy to second guess. Had it been a one-on-one race, the Republicans probably would have put a lot more resources in the primary.
Into targeting her, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about Barbara Bree. What's her background?
Barbara Bree is a high-tech entrepreneur. She helped start ProFlowers as well as a number of other high-tech businesses.
Okay. So that one's going to a runoff, and it's looking pretty good for the Democrats right now, but who knows what'll happen in November. There's one other seat in play also. Tell us about that one.
The other seat is District 9, and Ricardo Flores came in first place and will be in a runoff with nonprofit executive health advocate Georgette Gomez. Those are both Democrats. It's the seat currently represented by Marty Emerald, and all four of the people that were running are Democrats. It is expected,
that's a heavily Democratic district. So, yeah, Marty Emerald, of course, is retiring. So that seat obviously will be held by Democrats. So you're right. So it's just that one coastal district is really where the future of the city council's balance of power is hanging right now.
And with the Republican mayor, whether the Democrats or the Republicans hold a majority on the council, it's very interesting to watch.
Yeah, extremely important for the future of San Diego. Let's move on to the city attorney race. Now, how many people were running? It was quite a few, I understand.
Yes, five people actually were running in the city attorney's race. The Democrats had pretty much solidified around Rafael Castellanos and Gil Cabrera, neither one of which made it into the runoff. However, Mara Elliott is a registered Democrat. She's a chief deputy city attorney. She was supported by Marty Emerald.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So who is the Republican that made it into that runoff?
Robert Hickey. He was the only Republican running. There were mm-hmm. five people running. He was the only Republican. He did come in first place with 29% of the vote.
Yeah, and then the Democratic candidate got how much?
Well, the rest of them were Democrats.
So he got 29 and everybody else together got about 71%. So that one's sounding pretty positive for the Democrats too, I would imagine.
It is. It is. And especially if we see a gender gap, between Robert Hickey and Mara Elliott. And that could also be part of the reason why she made it into the runoff. There were four men and one woman.
Very interesting. Well, San Diego seems to have a pretty long and proud tradition of electing strong women candidates. We certainly saw a lot of them Tuesday night at Election Central. People like Tony Atkins, the former Speaker of the Assembly, who is now running for the state Senate seat that Marty Block is retiring from.
There are, especially in the city of San Diego.
Yeah, definitely. Everything from Bonnie DeMonis, the district attorney, to our two U.S. senators who are women, and now two women that have made it into the finals there.
Although Mara Elliott will be the first Democrat woman if she wins as city attorney.
So we could be cracking through one more glass ceiling for women here in the city of San Diego in November.
Very well may.
Very interesting. Well, Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for all of the commentary and following these races and joining us on the East County Magazine Show.
Thank you, Miriam.
three dozen candidates vied in the primary race to replace California's U.S. Senator Barbara Boxer, a long-serving Democrat who is stepping down. The November runoff will be between two Democratic women, both minorities, the state's Attorney General, Kamala Harris, and 10-term Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez. Harris is leading, with 40% of the vote to Sanchez 17%. Finishing a distant third place was Duff Sundheim, the Republican Party chair, and all remaining candidates were in the low single digits. That's with 100% of the precincts counted statewide and only some mail-in and provisional ballots remaining. Senator Boxer has been a U.S. senator for the past 24 years and says she wants to come home to California, the state she loves. After her victory, Harris stated, "We will continue to run a campaign that is about fighting for the ideals of our country. We have so many challenges as a country, and we are prepared to lead," she added. Harris says her goals include passing comprehensive immigration reform, combating climate change, reforming the criminal justice system, and eliminating that income divide that is making so many families suffer. Sanchez touts her record of achievements in Congress, notably her votes against the Iraq War, financial bailout, and the Patriot Act, as well as her service on the Armed Services and Homeland Security Committees, the Sacramento Bee reports. Congresswoman Sanchez concludes, "It's all about taking the tough votes." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Republicans have a shot to pick up a seat on the Grossmont-Cuyamaca Community College District Board in November. In Tuesday's primary, Timothy Cruthers won 59% of the vote in the school board's District 4 race. He will run off in November against Elena Adams, who received 33% of the vote. Incumbent Mary Kay Rosinski, who withdrew from the race but whose name still appeared on the ballot, got 9%. Although the race is nonpartisan, Rosinski was a Democrat and Adams has the backing of the Democratic Party after Rosinski's withdrawal. Cruthers is endorsed by the Republican Party, giving the GOP a chance to pick up a seat on the Community College Board in November. Rosinski had faced criticisms from conservatives over her support of a project labor agreement requiring union-scale pay for construction projects in the district. Cruthers opposes the project labor agreement and favors open bidding on projects. Adams is an educator with the San Diego Community College District who also serves on the local executive board of the American Federation of Teachers. Cruthers is a La Mesa chiropractor who also serves as a trustee in the Alpine Union School District. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Meridian Broaddus.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show. Next up, we hope you'll enjoy one of our Best of East County segments, our interview with Nancy Nunke at the Hearts and Hands Zebra Rescue Facility in Ramona. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at the San Diego Performance Academy. My guest today is Nancy Nunke, who is the Executive Director of the Hearts and Hands Animal Rescue. It's an education and therapy center, and they do some amazing things with some very special animals, including zebras. You heard it right. We have a zebra ranch right here in East County. Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Miriam.
Now, I have to ask, how did you develop an interest in zebras, of all things? How did this get started?
Well, it happened many decades ago. I was a horse trainer, and I showed horses. And I had a wildlife park call me and ask me if I could train a zebra they had a problem with. And apparently this two-year-old little stallion was chewing at people through the chain-link fence and didn't make it too inviting for the people who came to see him. So I said, of course, and my heart was going pitter-patter, and I had no idea whatsoever what I was getting myself into. But this wild little zebra ended up coming to my barn, and within about 10 seconds, I realized it was not a horse with stripes.
It was a horse of a different color, in a sense. How did you realize that? What happened?
He wasn't trained at all, and I had to send him into my barn, into an open stall, and the second that I shut the bottom door of the Dutch doors of his stall, he started coming out over the top door.
Uh-oh.
And so that was some pretty fast action we had to do. And just all of his behaviors just showed us that this was not even a typical what a wild horse would do.
Wow.
So I had a lot of homework to do. So what I did was spent the next 60 days at a different wildlife park. And I went every morning and stayed till nighttime, and I observed their zebra group. And
interesting.
So that's how I learned enough just to get him to the point where I could take him back and put 90 days later to his wildlife park, and he'd no longer chewed on the fence. But it began a lifetime of my love and devotion to the zebras.
Now, you now have various types of zebras at your ranch. How many varieties do you have?
We have all three species, including the Grevy's, which is the largest of the zebras, and they have a large mule-like head and very large umbrella-type ears, and they have a very narrow striping pattern, and it's vertical on their body, and they're endangered. And then the second one, which is vulnerable here and endangered in a lot of countries, it's going to be considered endangered very shortly.
So you're actually helping to preserve the endangered species.
Yes, we are, yeah.
And you're USDA licensed and everything, right?
Absolutely, USDA and Fish and Game and so on. So the second one is the Hartman's Mountain Zebra. And in fact, we just had a baby born this year. He's just about 3 months old. Thank you. And it's been 4 years for us. So it's just wonderful that we were able to have this little baby born and able to share it with the public, you know. And so they're the second size. They're the kind of the middle size zebra. And then the other one is the Grant Zebra or the Plain Zebra. And they're what's considered the most common zebra. But every year, thousands and thousands are being depleted. So they're much less common. And it's not really a good word to use for them anymore.
Wow, that's really sad. But it's good that you're able to help work on saving the species, even if it's in captivity. Now, you've developed a reputation for some amazing training techniques that you do with these zebras. In fact, I understand you're known as the zebra whisperer.
I guess that's what they call me. Yes.
Yeah, you do something called friendship training.
Friendship training is something that the zebras taught me.
Tell us what that involves.
Friendship training is something that I developed over several decades with the zebras. Zebras cannot be force trained, and force training is something that is used with horses. Sometimes we decide ourselves, you know, what is force training and what isn't force training, and then we say, well, this is natural training, natural horsemanship, and there's a variety of people out there that are using natural horsemanship in how they define it. But really, it's the animal that decides whether it's force training or not. So horses are domesticated, and they are much more submissive to our ways of training them. They don't fight very much. And so it's very difficult to know if we're forcing them to do something or if we're asking them to politely to do it, because most of the times they'll just do it. But with zebras, when you use typical horse training on them, they will say absolutely not, and they'll fight.
And that can even be dangerous. I know you've told me zebras don't make good pets because of their temperament. Tell us about that.
That's very correct. Children should never be around zebras. And you know, occasionally we have a little baby or something, but I mean a full-size zebra. Because of the way that they have to be trained, and that's what friendship training is all about, which is we become the animal to train the animal. And when you do that, a zebra will become your very best friend. And zebras, in the plain zebras, the Grants, each has one best friend in their group. And if someone else in the group tries to interfere with that friendship, like walking between them, coming to eat with the two friends, they will get shunned, they will get kicked, they will get bitten. And until human beings understand that the zebra social protocol is friendship-based, then people can't train zebras. Mm-hmm. And yet here with friendship training at Hearts and Hands Animal Rescue, we train zebra after zebra after zebra after zebra, and have proven over many decades that friendship training, which is the way they train mm-hmm. each other, is the way to go.
Yeah, I've seen this in action at your ranch, and it's really amazing what you've accomplished with some of these animals. Now, zebras aren't the only animals at the ranch. Another unusual animal that you have there is the wild Mongolian horse, or Przewalski's horse, that was actually extinct, I understand, or down to just one stallion in the whole world left in the wild. Tell us about these.
Yes, these are just absolutely amazing horses. Until several years ago, I had never even seen one myself mm-hmm. In person. And then all of a sudden, we have 12 of them that we had to rescue.
Yeah, and we should add that what happened was when it was discovered there was only one left in the wild, a search was made to find some that were in captivity and to begin breeding them. And so how many are there left in the world today?
There are about 1,200 now in the world.
Wow.
Coming from just 9 breedable animals.
Amazing.
That were found in a zoo. So, you know, people can talk about zoos and say there shouldn't be any, but if there weren't, there would be so many species of endangered animals that would now be extinct.
Sure.
And we would never have the opportunity to see them again or to breed them and mm-hmm. then put them back in the wild, as we've now done with the pea horses.
That's wonderful.
There are 3 groups
yeah,
back in the wild now.
That's wonderful. And what have you found these horses to be like when you worked with the Przewalski's horses? What are they like? What are some of the challenges you face there?
Well, just like the zebra, and in fact even more so, they will not be force trained. And that is why no one has ever been able to train them. Even Genghis Khan and his henchmen could never train these Przewalski's horses.
So the Mongol hordes could not bring this Mongolian wild horse to be tamed.
That's right. So when we had one little one come on her own to us, an orphan, I thought that would be a great opportunity since I couldn't introduce her as so young into one of the other groups.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, let's try some friendship training with her and see. Maybe this could work.
And it did.
Well, she took to it just immediately. She's now 3 years old, and she's even inviting us to get on her back.
My goodness.
And this is something that no one has ever seen with these horses, and people have tried for yeah. centuries to train them, even in our modern-day societies where they're in zoos. They bring in the top horse trainers and have tried to train these horses, mm-hmm. and no one's been successful. And here at Hearts and Hands Animal Rescue with friendship training, it just was so normal for her to be trained this way. And there was absolutely just no issues with it. And to me, she's just like another horse. But when
Great.
You approach her in a different manner, the way people approach horses, all of a sudden she becomes a pea horse again.
Now, another very special horse you have there is called the Caspian horse. And this one, it's a small breed of horse, but very strong, I understand. And it was thought to be gone from the face of this earth. And then how was it rediscovered?
Well, it's very interesting. They were thought to be gone for 1,300 years.
My goodness.
And this is the horse that when you are over in Persia, in the Persian countries, mm-hmm. you will see in the architecture, you'll see soldiers in their ancient warrior garb riding these teeny horses, and the feet of the men are right down to the ankles of the horses.
Wow.
And when I saw those, I thought those were just caricatures of, you know, mm-hmm. of the real thing. And in fact, that's exactly what
wow.
it is. These horses are 11 to 13 hands tall. And so good difference of, you know, 8 inches difference mm-hmm. in the lower to the higher height range. But what makes them so fascinating is that a full grown, you know, an adult about 150 mm-hmm. pounds can ride these horses. And there is yeah. a physical reason for that with the horse. And that is that their scapula, their shoulder bone is actually the same width as it is on a 15-hand quarter horse.
Wow, that's amazing. And the story behind this, I understand, is there was an American woman that was visiting over there in what used to be known as Persia, now Iran, and she saw a peddler with a horse pulling a cart, this small horse pulling this huge, heavy cart, and asked, where did it come from? And tell us what the answer was.
Yes, and he said he had gone up into the mountains when he needed a horse and would get a horse out of the mountains. There
wow.
were wild horses up there.
Yeah, and in this war-torn region, where obviously there's threats to them from more than the usual problems.
Correct.
So this woman then managed to get a few out out of the country and started a captive breeding program in addition to whatever's left in the wild there.
That's correct. She sent some to Australia, to England, and to the United States. I think we got 24 here. Well, there's about 900 in the world now. And we have we have registration associations for them. People just don't know this horse, and yet this horse trains up. So in 30 days, you can train a horse well enough for a child to ride it.
So this is not a wild thing like the Przewalskis or the zebras. This is something that actually is accustomed to domestication because, as you've noted, the soldiers use them for riding purposes. 1,300 years or more ago.
Yes, this is one of the most ancient breeds of horse in the world. And the oldest breed of horse in the world with a single toe is actually the Przewalski's horse.
My goodness, isn't that amazing? An interesting bit of trivia, by the way, about back to the zebras for a moment, is that they actually used to be found in San Diego County, I understand. There were giant zebras that roamed the Anza-Borrego Desert at one time.
I don't know how giant they were, but there is a skull of a zebra that was found in the desert, and they have it in the museum down there.
There were once zebras roaming the Anza-Borrego Desert. Another thing that you do, now you do a lot of not just rescue. Most of the animals you take in now actually are rescues that come from other places where maybe they were abused, an owner died. You've taken in everything from Zorses to zonkies that are mixes of zebras and horses, zebras and donkeys, zebras where the owner can't care for them anymore. But you also use a lot of these animals for education and therapy, working with people who've maybe been in accidents, been injured themselves. Tell us about a couple of the animals that you've used for that are so inspiring to people.
Well, our program is very unique, our therapy program. We like to call it our wellness program. So we have people come in for various situations with PTSD. We have burn survivors. We have, again, people who have been in debilitating accidents. We have people who are suffering from grief, which can be very debilitating. Yeah. And grief can come in various fashions, whether it's from having a loved one die or losing a job, moving, changing schools. You know, there's so many reasons why people actually will grieve. But we use our animals that have very similar stories to what the person coming in would have. So, for example, we have a little horse named Chansey who came to us over 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And Chansey had been attacked by a pack of dogs, and his neck had been broken. Mm. His shoulders had been displaced by 6 inches. Wow. And his upper muzzle had been removed completely. Unfortunately, it had eaten by one of the dogs, so it was never able to be recovered.
But you've done
amazing
things, though, to help the tissue regrow over the teeth and everything in the mouth.
So he's been in recovery with us for 3 years. His neck is completely better. His shoulders are back in place, and we're talking about 6 hours minimum every single day for over a year.
Yeah, you're a no-kill facility. It was very impressive when I visited to see you have animals that were. You know, the advice had been put them down, they'll never walk again. You have many where you've been able to actually help them be able to walk again when they were thought to be paralyzed.
Yes, yeah. And it's just a matter of being determined. You know, we don't make those decisions for the animals. If they want to eat and they want to drink, that means they want to live. Mm-hmm. And so we just do whatever it takes. And we have so many wonderful therapists that come and help us and volunteer and share their time with the animals so that they can recover. And it, just like people, there's no magic number of days, weeks, months, or even years in recovery. We have a zebra. His name is Zinti. He has his own Facebook page, Zinti the
Zinti
Zebra.
Zinti the Zebra.
Z-I-N-T-Y. Z-I-N-T-Y. And Zinti is our comedian. He's a resident comedian. And he broke his pelvis 7 years ago. And he has one leg shorter than the other. He gets around the ranch. He's our mascot. He runs all over the ranch. Well, he does his special little hitching his giddy up gate all over the ranch.
Wow.
But he wants to be here, and his sense of humor is the most amazing thing, you know. So a lot of people think that because an animal has an injury that it just should be put down, you know. And that's just another way, they call it a polite way of saying kill. Yeah. But that's not something we do at the ranch. And so these animals, for the rest of their lives, give back to humans. And the sharing and the relationships are the most amazing things that you see develop between our wellness people and these animals.
Obviously, obviously it's very expensive to care for this many animals. One of the things that you do to raise funds, although you're not breeding and selling these exotic species, but you do breed miniature spotted donkeys, beautiful animals, and Bengal cats, I understand.
Yes, those are my personal animals, and I breed them to help support the rescue. 100% of the money goes to the rescue.
Well, there you go.
So and those are animals that you would rarely, if ever, see in a rescue. Mm-hmm. So the people that are looking for those animals are looking specifically one of those and not to a rescue for them.
So. Right. Now, you also have something very unusual. I understand that you just within the last couple of weeks got into the Guinness Book of World Records recently. Tell us about that.
Well, we're not quite there yet. We're just waiting for our approval.
Okay.
But we did do our Guinness Book of World Records attempt for the world record for the smallest bull, B-U-L-L.
And how small is he?
He's 28 and 3/16 inches tall.
Oh my goodness, I think I have a cat that's almost that big.
Yes, he's very, very tiny. And something really exciting is that we also, in the same group of little cows that came into us, that we also have a little girl whose name is Bluebell.
Wow. And we these are rescue animals, to be clear. Yeah.
Yes, they were actually very thin and they were mangy. Someone purchased them who knew us. They were at a sale and they brought them to us. And so, of course, they're very healthy now and
what kind of
chubby.
What species of bull is this?
It's called a miniature zebu.
Zebu.
Yeah, zebu. And these are one of the most ancient breeds of cattle, and they're naturally very tiny, and they're from India and Sri Lanka.
Fascinating. Do you only handle exotic animals, Nancy, or do you ever take in domestics?
We actually have about one-third is exotics, and then two-thirds is our local domestic animals, including dogs, cats, you know, chickens, goats, birds, and a lot of horses.
Wonderful.
And so anybody who's looking to adopt a horse, a full-size horse, or even a miniature horse, please give us a call because we might have the animal for you.
Well, very good. That's wonderful to know. Now, you've withstood, like so many in East County, the tragedy of the 2007 wildfire. I understand that it destroyed the entire ranch.
Yes, we were very fortunate that we had an early warning of the fire. We could see it right from the ranch when it first started. And we also saw that the wind was, we did the old finger test and, it was coming our way. So
this was in Ramona, the Witch Creek fire,
yes, Witch Creek fire.
Through there so fast. Yes. It was really almost no warning.
So we had about, we had six horse trailers in 6 hours. And all we could do was just keep taking the animals off the ranch.
And you managed to save all of them?
And we managed to save all of the larger animals.
Wonderful.
And just a few of the birds that were set free. There was no time to, you know, be able to catch them. Ended up going back into their pens. So it was a very, very sad time for us, as well as a time of elation that we were able to get almost everything off of the ranch.
But all the large and all these endangered animals.
Yes, we got everything off. So it was wonderful. But it devastated the entire ranch.
And you lost your home.
We lost the residents. We lost everything there. All of the equipment, all the feed carts, the truck, one of the vehicles.
What kind of insurance did you have adequate insurance for that?
Unfortunately, we were underinsured intentionally by our insurance company.
Many
people were at that time. And so a little bit of insurance that we did get instead of building the residence with it, we had to bring all the animals back because they were in temporary places.
Yeah, so you chose to take care of the animals at your own expense instead of rebuilding your own home up there.
Yes, that's what happened.
Are you still hoping to rebuild someday?
The house has, it's got framing around it, and it's been sitting there, and we're hoping to get it finished.
Yeah. Wow. Do you need volunteers at the ranch? Can people come and help in that way?
We do need volunteers. We're always grateful when people would like to spend a day a week or more volunteering their time to help out. There's so much to do still after the fire. There's still so much to do in getting the ranch back to the way it was prior to that. And we really need volunteers to help us with fundraising events.
So you just had a music festival, I understand. And what else is coming up?
Yeah, we had a music festival. We also did the Amazing Pet Expo. And we have the Night of the Horse coming up, where in April, on April 19th, where we have been asked to partake in the basically the greatest horse show on earth.
Where and when will that be?
And that'll be at Del Mar. Mm-hmm. There'll be a lot of great acts that come in, and this is our first year to participate, and we're actually
going
to be doing the rare and endangered animals. So we will have the availability of people to come in and see Azorus, Azonki, a couple of zebras, and Kaya the Przewalski's horse.
Now, you're nonprofit, so I assume that people can, you accept donations, is that correct? If people are able to do that or wish to?
Yes, we're 501c3 nonprofit, so that works for everybody's taxes. And so we definitely will accept all the donations that come in and put it to good use to feed and house and care for all the animals.
Beautiful. And again, I'm talking with Nancy Nunke with the Hearts and Hands Animal Rescue in Ramona. What is your website for people who wish to get more information or find out how they can help and get involved?
Our website is hhar.org.
hhar.org. Well, very good. And are there opportunities if people want to visit the ranch? Do you ever have times where it's open to the public or where you do tours or anything like that, Nancy?
Yes, people can call us, actually, and then we set up for tours. Mm-hmm. We do have three different ways that we tour, the hour-and-a-half tour, which is the shorter one, and then the two-hour tour, and then we actually have a three-hour tour, and in that one, we actually show people how we work with friendship training with the animals.
It's very wonderful. I've been on one of these tours, I know, and it was quite, I mean, you know, a media tour, but it was quite amazing and just really a very uplifting and fascinating place to visit. So, Nancy, I want to thank you very much for joining us here today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
You're listening to East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
And now we have an interview with Helen Oldfield, another oldie but goodie, this one with the late Gary McClintock, master saddle maker from Descanso.
This is Helen Oldfield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society bringing you the sounds of history. The sound of hoofbeats, the smell of sagebrush, the brilliant blue sky overhead. This is the world of my guest today, Gary McClintock, president of McClintock Saddle Works in Descanso, and one of East County's most famous residents. McClintock is to saddles what Willie Shoemaker was to horse racing. Their skills are enormous and particular. Gary, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Helen. That's well said and a little overstated, but thank you so much for such a nice introduction.
Oh,
I appreciate that.
Never, never, Gary, never overstated. I think you're one of the most popular people in East County and in the horse world.
I hope I don't have to live up to that.
You're such a Westerner, but where were you born and how long have you lived in East County?
Well, actually, I was born in Santa Monica, California, so I've lived my whole life in California. Came to San Diego in the 60s for college and have moved out to East County about that same time and kind of felt that this was a nice spot for me, so I've been there ever since.
So you were a city boy.
We lived on the beach, actually, Helen.
Oh,
we
golly.
In a place called Playa del Rey. So we started on the coast of California in the 50s. I was born in 1948, and we lived in a little place called Playa del Rey, which is right on the coast, underneath the airport, pretty close to that.
My goodness, this makes you a quintessential Californian because you have experienced everything from the coast, the beautiful coast, the freeways, the incessant traffic, the smog. And what lured you to East County, to Descanso?
Well, actually, I was here for college at San Diego State.
Oh, yes.
And at that time, I actually moved to East County with a group of friends, college students that needed a place to live. And we found a little place in Pine Valley back in about 1967, 68.
I have seen your custom saddles, and they are stunning. How long have you been making saddles?
Well, actually, Helen, we started in 1973, so this is my 40th year. We're celebrating our 40th anniversary right now. This is actually 40 years of building saddles.
What drives a young man to want to do that?
I think the desire to live out of town was the start. I wanted to work with my hands. I come from a family of dentists who also work with their hands, you see. But I was kind of a kickback of the hippie era and had to get out of town and live in the mountains and be away from the city. And it stuck with me. And I found saddles was something a friend recommended that I could. We were making belts before that. And then the recommendation came along and I went to a school to learn how to build them because it was something I could do on my own, one at a time. I didn't have to be a factory or a manufacturer, which is what we became as belt makers. We got to the point where we were manufacturing belts for Pennies and Sears and people like that. Then I thought, no, I just want to be the custom little maker that I seen down in Mexico, to tell you the truth, down in San Blas, Mexico, on a surfing voyage. We were down in the square there and observed some artisans making belts and handbags and saddles. Well, not saddlebags, sandals, and then handbags. So we had the opportunity to enjoy that and thought, well, this guy has a pretty decent lifestyle. Right here on the coast, he can just do what he wants and sell it and catch waves when...
There's a real cultural context for this. The 1970s are often referred to as the time of the rebirth of the American craftsman. And there was a tremendous interest at that time in the handcrafted item. And actually, who was in the White House then? Mrs. Mondale.
Oh, really?
Made a big deal about bringing handmade pottery into the White House and serving dinners and whatnot on things made by artisans from America. So you were right in that groove. On average, if there is an average, how long does it take to design and make a Western saddle?
It's a good 7-day project. It takes a good 7 days to complete it. As long as it doesn't have a lot of the floral tooling, the carving or tooling, that takes somewhat more time. You could put another 40 hours into that if it was fully carved, you know, with the carving that you see, the floral decoration.
So someone comes to you and says, I must have a Western saddle. It needs to look in a certain way. It's on this particular kind of horse.
Exactly. I get a lot of people that come to me because they can't find first something that's going to work for their horse. So I accommodate that particular type of a horse by fitting the horse, you might say. I go out and take a look at it, which is what I'm going to do this afternoon. I'm on my way to Ramona this afternoon to take a look at a guy's horse and make sure that we get the right size saddle for him. His vet recommended that he come to me because I have a reputation of accommodating that type of a need. So that's where a lot of it starts there. A lot of it starts with people who can't find the style of saddle they prefer, let alone the size seat that fits them in that style with that fit for the horse. So there's three features there that they have to accommodate, and your typical manufactured products don't do that.
You know, when I was researching this topic, I came across a man who chewed the leather and pounded it with a mallet to make it pliable. And I assume you are not chewing the leather, but if you are, don't hesitate to share. Where do you get saddle leather? And do you have a favorite kind?
Well, there's a couple of tanneries left in the United States. The best tannery for that particular type of a vegetable tan leather, it's quite thick leather. It's done back in St. Louis. They do the best quality for saddles. There's been others, and there still are other makers, but a lot of EPA, Environmental Protection Agency stuff, has driven certain tanneries out of different areas like Los Angeles. There was quite a few makers there. A lot of it's being done in China, Mexico, out of the state and imported back. But the particular leather that I use comes out of St. Louis, Missouri, the Herman Oaks Tanning Company. So it's made here in the United States still, and it's just a real good quality leather all the way around for all the features I need. I mean, I need a certain thickness. I need a leather that will tool easily, mold easily to the tree that I make the saddle upon.
Okay, the tree is the wooden...
It's the wooden frame that's been covered with rawhide. Rawhide is untanned leather.
Gary, is there any one saddle maker in history who inspired you?
Not an individual, but a company called the Visalia Saddle Company of California. I became, along the way, I got quite interested in historical stuff, California stuff, California vaquero. I was consulted by a member, a guy named Ibanez from the Times newspaper up in Los Angeles. He requested a saddle out of this old catalog. This is like maybe 1975, 76, and it had some particular decoration on it that was braiding. It was rawhide braiding, and I just loved the look of it. And so I, from his request, I had to learn how to do all this stuff. And I went to, here in San Diego, there was a gentleman in the mountains out in Descanso named Granville Martin. And I spent time with him learning how to prepare this rawhide and then how to apply it to the saddle and make a nice decorative trim on the saddle, which is what Visalia used to do.
Nice.
And I thought, well, this is great. And so I've done a lot of saddles over the years that have that rawhide trim on it.
Gary, is it fair to say that your saddles are all over the United States?
Oh, absolutely.
All over North America?
Europe, quite a few there. Quite a few in northern Mexico. I sold saddles to cowboys and vaqueros down in, starting in about Tecate and maybe down as far as Ensenada. And I know there's even further, about halfway down the peninsula where we filmed the video, Corazon Vaquero, there's a couple of guys down there that I traded some saddles for.
Gary, that's a great segue. We're going to come back and renew this conversation. We're almost out of time. But Gary is not riding off into the sunset just yet. We're going to continue this conversation next time. Sit around, maybe chew some leather.
Probably not, hopefully, right?
Gary McClintock, thank you for coming. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen O'Field.
The Association of California Healthcare Districts has recognized the Grossmont Healthcare District with its best practices in governance certification. The designation signifies that Grossmont is compliant with the association's standards for demonstrating open and transparent business practices for the benefit of communities served. Grossmont is the 11th healthcare district in the state to receive the recognition since the association introduced its certification program in 2014. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Liz Alper.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
Smoking or vaping at state beaches and parks, or disposing of tobacco products at these locations may soon be illegal under Senate Bill 1333, a measure authored by Senator Marty Block, a San Diego Democrat. The measure is passed the state Senate by a 25-11 bipartisan vote. Senator Block says, "We have an obligation to value and preserve our environmental treasures. SB 1333 will help to keep our state parks and beaches clean and safe by removing exposure to secondhand smoke and in reducing the threat of park fires." He added that cigarette litter poses a detrimental effect on the environment and wildlife. Cigarettes are non-biodegradable and contain more than 164 toxic chemicals. They can be ingested by wildlife and fish, which leads to the contamination of our oceans and waterways. SB 1333 would make it an infraction to dispose used cigarettes or tobacco waste in parks or waterways and impose a maximum fine of $250 for a violation of the law. Reporting for the East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Iverson.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show.
We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, royalty-free music, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.